The future may look grim, but do we have a choice about it?
The future is not destiny. The future is choice. And if we go down the path where we start to invent new innovations to tap these renewable energy flows, we will learn things that we would not or could not learn without actually trying to do these things.
That's Jonathan Kumi. His book, Cold Cash, Cool Climate, shows how we could ignite a new era of entrepreneurship with good domestic jobs for a cleaner, cooler planet. And Philip Warburg naysays the skeptics in his book about wind power, Harvest the Wind.
We could be providing half of our electricity from wind if we made a very serious investment in building out a smart grid that could transport wind from the areas where it's most abundant to the areas where the power is most needed.
That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. To many these days, the future looks pretty grim. Atmospheric carbon has just passed a scary milestone, 400 parts per million. That's about 50 parts per million higher than what we need to maintain a safe climate. There are many who say we need proven technologies like natural gas and nuclear power to cut carbon emissions because renewables like wind and solar just aren't ready for prime time. But my guest, John Kumi, says we can choose a better future by scaling up technology we already have and making it better with practice. That's the way we did it with digital technology. If we'd waited until we had the perfect personal computer, we'd still all be using typewriters and listening to our music on tape decks. Kumi says we can learn best by doing, not waiting for some pie-in-the-sky time when every green technology is perfected in the lab before putting it on the market. Kumi's book, Cold Cash, Cool Climate, is addressed to entrepreneurs, but it makes fascinating reading for anyone. A scientist, engineer, and entrepreneur himself, Kumi builds a compelling case for getting to the green energy future, despite a paralyzed Congress and an entrenched fossil fuel industry. It's one of the best and clearest books I've read on how to get there from here. Jonathan Kumi, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thanks very much for having me.
You are an entrepreneur in clean energy. First, tell us a little bit about what you were as an entrepreneurial scientist, or I shouldn't use a past tense, should I?
No, you shouldn't use the past tense. So I actually worked at Lawrence Berkeley National Lab for about two decades, and I've also been a visiting professor at Yale and Stanford and UC Berkeley. But I've also been an entrepreneur advising companies who are trying to do something good for the environment and also make a profit in the bargain. And so I'm trying to apply the lessons that I learned as a research scientist to the problem of climate and helping people who are working on ventures in this area to really understand what the science says about the problem and how that science can help you better focus your efforts to find opportunities that will reduce emissions and also make a profit in the bargain.
This book I found quite readable, even though I'm not a scientist, and really fascinating for the general public as well, because you explain so well what the science is and also how we need to think about the future. You know, a lot of people have been talking about people who are climate hawks is what I would say. People who are serious about the climate have been bemoaning the fact that, at least in the United States, under the onslaught of climate denialism, so many Americans, you know, less believe in human-caused climate change than have before. And so some people are saying we need to start talking about technological change, energy, clean energy, not in the context of climate, but in the context of, you know, products that are fun as well as good for you. And that's something that you say as well.
Well, I actually, I disagree with the people who say we shouldn't talk about climate, mm-hmm. because this is a real issue, and we need to understand the dimensions of the problem so that we can properly address it. I do think that talking about clean energy is a powerful way to get people to focus on many of the benefits that are associated with getting off of fossil fuels. And one of the things that you see is that when an industry has existed for a long time, people tend to ignore some of the social effects of that industry, and in part because of the economic importance of that industry. So, for example, there are, of course, many jobs in the fossil fuel industry, and that's always the argument, is that, oh, if you do something about fossil fuels or combustion, you're gonna kill all these jobs. And that's a false dichotomy, because what happens is that we're going to meet our demand for energy services somehow, and either we're going to meet that demand with current technologies using oil or coal or natural gas, or we're going to meet them with some other new technologies. And both choices lead to jobs. So it's not a question of fossil fuels or no jobs. It's a question of fossil fuel jobs or jobs building wind turbines. And the thing that people need to think about is, what kind of world do you prefer to live in? And I personally think that a world where we figure out how to harness the natural energy flows of the Earth will be much better for the environment, much better for human health, and for our economy as a whole.
Not to speak of survivability for us.
Of course. Yeah, of course. So there's the general issue of really mucking up the global systems on which we all depend. And that, of course, is something we want to avoid as best we can.
Mm-hmm. Now, could paint a picture for us. What could it look like? Let's say if we take the path that we're going to talk about today, the path in your book, Cold Cash, Cool Climate, do we have to sacrifice our quality of life? Do we have to sacrifice our iPads, our fun technology, in order to have the clean energy future that we need?
I don't think so. And so the main issue is thinking about the path we're on now, thinking about what that will lead to, and then we have to decide what we're willing to do to avoid the damages that are associated with that current path. And so let's talk a little bit about that current path, because I think most people don't fully appreciate the scale of the climate problem that we're going to have to address here. So people have been studying the climate for a long time, and we have a pretty good sense for how the warmth of the Earth will be related to the amount of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. And we know this from history, Earth's history. We also know it from analyzing the effects of different levels of greenhouse gases on Mars and on Venus, and then measuring the temperature there. So we have a pretty good idea of what happens when you change the greenhouse gas concentrations in the atmosphere. And right now, we're on track for doubling those greenhouse gas concentrations, not once, but twice, by the year 2100. So a factor of four compared to where we were in pre-industrial times. And what the climate scientists say is that for every doubling of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, you'll increase the average temperature of the Earth by 3 degrees Celsius. So we're in for two doublings if we keep doing what we're doing. And that means an average temperature increase of 6 degrees Celsius, or about 10.8 degrees Fahrenheit. And if you think about that, that's a remarkable thing. First off, that's the average temperature increase. So that, in certain places, the temperature increase will be higher, for example, at the poles. And that means, essentially, within the next couple hundred years, an ice-free planet Earth and sea levels much, much higher than they are today. So that world is one that we want to avoid. And it's not a world in which I want my identical twin sons to grow up in. So I think it's time to change our direction.
And what about the cost of delay? You say that it costs something like for every... Now I don't have the figure in front of me. The cost that every certain number of years that we delay, another $500 billion.
Yeah, that's the number. So the International Energy Agency actually analyzed what the cost of delay would be. And what they did was they said, here's the target that we think we need to get to preserve a safer climate. and here are all the investments that we would need to get there. And what they recognize, and I think all people who understand the problem recognize, is that delay doesn't help you, because what the climate problem is caused by emissions of gases that stay in the atmosphere for a very long time. So it's not the annual emissions that matter. It's the cumulative emissions over the next 50 or 100 years. And so if you simply delay acting, what happens is you just put more greenhouse gases in the atmosphere and you eat up the what we call the carbon budget. So you have this fixed amount that you can emit to stay under some temperature limit. And if you use it up now, it means it won't be available later. So you'll just have to have much more rapid reductions later on. It also, if you delay, also you're building carbon-intensive infrastructure that will have to be scrapped in order to meet the demands of the safer climate case. So delay is really a false economy. People think, oh, we'll wait and see and save money, but unfortunately, as the IEA found out, every year of delay costs us an additional $500 billion to fixing the problem.
We're talking with Jonathan Kumi. He is a research scientist and entrepreneur. His book is Cold Cash, Cool Climate. You know, this, what you just said about building fossil fuel intensive infrastructure came home to me today as I was listening to a report on the radio on NPR. I have to say, it appeared uncritical report about developing unconventional oil, shale oil resources in the United States. And of course, we've also been hearing a lot about the XL pipeline, the XL Keystone pipeline from Canada, developing the shale oil sands there. Is this an example of the kind of fossil fuel infrastructure that you're talking about?
Yeah, absolutely. And so the thing that people need to understand about the tar sands, which is the where the XL pipeline was coming from in Canada, is that that resource for oil is much more energy intensive to extract and process than conventional oil. And so there are a variety of studies about this, but the additional emissions associated with that particular source is, say, 20 to 30% above conventional oil. And it represents a mostly untapped fossil fuel resource that is now being exploited. And the more pipelines we build to ship that oil, the more infrastructure we build to process that oil, the more capital that will eventually have to be scrapped to meet the demands of the safer climate case. So we're at this particular turning point in human history where we have a certain amount of carbon and other greenhouse gases we can put in the atmosphere, and if we derive our energy in ways that are more carbon intensive, it means that we're going to use up that carbon budget faster than if we use less carbon intensive fuels.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with scientist, engineer, and businessman John Kumi about his new book, Cold Cash, Cool Climate. Interestingly enough, this report on, I believe it was Morning Edition, was followed by a report that said that renewables, they talked about the difficulty with renewables because they cannot be easily incorporated into the electric grid. So what's your comment on that? Unconventional fuels is a very difficult, highly technical, technologically advanced way of wresting fossil fuels from the ground, and yet we are being told that renewable energy cannot be integrated into the electric grid.
Well, that's just factually wrong. I mean, the Danish electric grid has 30 or 40% of its electricity from wind. And that's a small, relatively small country. But in some parts of the U.S., you have 10, 15% of the electricity coming from wind at various parts of the year. The thing is that we're going to have to get a lot more clever at how we use these renewable energy flows. And so in the old days, the grizzled old utility guys, and they were all pretty much guys, would say, oh, you can't have more than 1% or 2% of these variable resources on your grid, or you're really going to mess things up. Well, we've pushed past that in some states, And what happens is that people figure out how to operate the grid in different ways. And we have, for example, more flexible power plants that can move up and down in response to a change in load. We're starting now to figure out ways to shape demand so that if the wind, for example, dies down for an hour, we can adjust the electricity demand in a way that will help mitigate that issue. There's other changes we can make in our system to help us become a lot more clever in how we use these renewable energy flows. So it's simply incorrect to say that we can't integrate these renewable energy flows into our electric grid.
It's just a question of putting our mind to it and creating a bit more research and development. Is that right?
Research and development, but also implementation, because some of these things require actually doing them before we learn how to do them well. Learning by doing requires that we do. So it's not just R&D, and I think that's a mistake that that some people make when they're thinking about this problem. They say, oh, we'll just wait and see. We'll do a bunch of R&D, and then we'll get some new technology that will save us. And if energy technology changes fast as computer technology, then that might make sense in some situations, but it doesn't. So that's a moot point.
Yeah, in fact, you say in your book, Jonathan Coomey, In Cold Cash, Cool Climate, that by learning by doing, we can actually create the future we want.
Yeah, so that's a very important point, is that the future is not destiny. The future is choice. And if we go down the path where we start to invent new innovations to tap these renewable energy flows, we will learn things that we would not or could not learn without actually trying to do these things. Simply doing R&D in a lab doesn't help you push energy technology to scale. And that's where the learning happens, the big important learning. So an example would be for solar cells on people's roofs or commercial buildings' roofs. The Germans have had a very aggressive program of subsidizing photovoltaics. And the U.S. has had some subsidies, but nowhere near what Germany has done. And what you see when you look at the actual data, the costs of installing these systems, you see that the cost per watt of installing systems in Germany is about $4 per watt. This was last year, I think. And then in the U.S., it's about $6 per watt. The cost of the solar cells is the same because it's set on the market. You know, it's set on the global market price for these commodities. But the installation costs in Germany are much, much less. And that's because they actually have pushed their own industry and their own local contractors to learn how to install these things more effectively. So that's an example of the kind of learning by doing that R&D doesn't help you with. But it's really important for reducing the total cost of installing new technology to reduce emissions.
Some people have talked about that we need an Apollo project. You say, no, we don't need an Apollo project. We need a Sputnik project. What's the difference between the two? How does what you've just said fit into that idea?
So people always talk about how we need a Manhattan project or an Apollo project, and it's this model where the government allocates a bunch of money and sequesters a lot of brilliant scientists in some place, and they come up with some innovation that just changes everything. And there is certainly a role for R&D and for brilliant scientists, but I think that's the wrong analogy for this problem. And the reason is that the changes that we'll need to tackle this problem are across the whole society. It's not a simple technical fix that's going to solve this problem. So we need actually the kind of societal mobilization that happened after the Soviet Union launched Sputnik. In the U.S., you saw massive increases in research and development, massive increases in funding for education, and we spent a huge amount of societal resources to build infrastructure and to focus our efforts on development of science and technology that would then be applied in the economy. And the Apollo project, you know, led to this brilliant, amazing development of getting people on the moon, but it was a very narrow technical project. And so that's why I like to talk about Sputnik, because it's a much broader societal mobilization. And that's really what we need to solve the climate problem.
And in fact, included, you know, science education in the schools all the way down to the elementary school level.
Exactly. Exactly right.
So we're talking about a Sputnik project. One of the ways you talk about this, too, is saying we can't just focus on fossil carbon, but we also have to talk about other pollutants. Tell us about that. And even, I believe I heard Hillary Clinton talking about this recently, saying that focusing on some other pollutants might get us, some, might buy us some time.
Yes. So this is a very important point. So carbon from combustion of fossil fuels mainly is the most important contributor to warming of the climate. But there are other gases as well that have a big impact. So methane is the chief constituent of natural gas. And so that can leak from pipelines, and that can lead to substantial warming. Also, it comes from agriculture. You also have emissions of soot. Sometimes people call this black carbon, but this is the dark particles that turn out to be very bad for human health, because if you get them in your lungs, they cause all sorts of problems. But they also, when they're deposited on snowfields, for example, increase warming. Because anything black, as we all know, absorbs the sunlight better than something white. And so that's what the Secretary of State was talking about. There are certain kinds of gases or pollutants that, if we focus on them, they can have a relatively quick impact on warming, because these pollutants have a shorter lifetime in the atmosphere than carbon dioxide, which stays in the atmosphere for hundreds or thousands of years. So that's what the Secretary was talking about, and I think it's a good strategy. There are plenty of ways to reduce emissions of methane, for example, that actually make money. So reducing emissions from pipelines will allow you to have more natural gas to sell, and that natural gas can then be used to displace higher carbon fuels. But if you have a lot of leakage of methane and you don't control that leakage, then as Tom Wigley points out, increased use of natural gas can actually hurt you from a climate perspective. So the important thing is, if you're going to use natural gas, which we will, at least as a transition fuel, you need to make sure that you are keeping the leakage from the pipelines and the drilling as low as possible.
We're talking with Jonathan Kumi about the do's and don'ts of building a sustainable energy future. His book is Cold Cash, Cool Climate. Can I just, as an aside, ask you, what's your opinion on the hydrofracking debate?
So this is a complex area, because this hydraulic fracking, where these companies will use high-pressure water and some chemicals underground to break up rock and free up deposits of natural gas, has actually driven the price of natural gas to low levels. So it's led to a plentiful supply of natural gas, but it's something that up until now has been mostly unregulated. And there's not even disclosure of some of the chemicals that are being put into the ground in many states. And so there's a certain basic level, there needs to be this kind of disclosure, understanding of what kind of chemicals are being put near the groundwater. And there are also issues potentially around earthquakes caused by certain kinds of processes in fracking. So it's complicated. It's something that people are still studying. But at the end of the day, you know, if we can do this in a way that reduces emissions of methane and then also displaces other fossil fuels, that's a good thing. But there's certainly concern, legitimate concern, that there's some increased leakage that's caused by this process. And it's something that we just don't have a good handle on right now. And mm-hmm. people are starting to focus on it. But it's definitely complicated.
Okay, so now back to your book, Jonathan Kumi, and Cold Cash, Cool Climate. You know, one of the things we talked before about cost and how much more costly delay will be. Another issue is the idea of feasibility in other ways, too. And you say that we can't accurately forecast the future. I thought this was a very interesting discussion. I wonder if I think you've referred to it in some ways, but if you could flesh this idea out for us a little bit more.
Okay, so one of the things that happens anytime people are confronted by a big challenge is that their current way of looking at the world kind of colors how they look at a problem. And what we see with the climate debate is that many people try to impose what I call their feasibility blinders on the problem and say, well, we can't really do whatever it is. We can't stop our use of fossil fuels. We can't change the way we operate our electricity grid. And I think from my study of the success or lack of success of energy forecasting over the decades, what we find is that we have almost no ability to accurately predict the future of energy systems. And that realization should make us a whole lot more reticent to make these kind of predictions where we say, we can't do this, we can't do that. And so that's why I'm focused on helping people envision and create the future instead of trying to predict what will happen. So an example would be a focus on some defined goal. I call in the book, I call for a safer climate case that would keep the global surface temperatures from rising more than 2 degrees Celsius over pre-industrial levels. So instead of trying to predict if we'll get there, what we need to do is say, we would like to get to this point in 50 years. What do we have to do to get there? And this is a more business-like way of looking at the problem. It's more like creating a business plan to achieve a big strategic goal. And that can allow you to break through people's informal feasibility blinders because it helps people envision a future that's very different from what they know now. And it allows them to kind of think through what would need to happen to get there.
And one thing you say needs to happen is a kind of whole systems design.
Yeah, this is whole systems design is a very important concept. And the modern champion of this concept is Amory Lovins. He calls it going back to Victorian design. But the main idea is that whenever we look at improving a system, instead of simply changing the parts of the system to make each part better, we need to look at the task that we're trying to perform and then redesign the whole system to accomplish that task in ever better ways. And that can lead to radical improvements, not just in energy and emissions, but also in the way people get those services and the cost of those services. So when you're talking about big changes, and that's exactly what we need to meet the climate challenge, one of the best ways to develop those new innovations is to think about the whole system and redesign from the bottom up.
What might be an example of that in terms of renewables?
Well, so the electric system is actually an example of that. So people think about the current system and they think of the demand from houses and buildings as kind of this thing over which we have no control. But actually, as soon as you start introducing pricing and other ways to control demand, suddenly that becomes a variable. It becomes something that you can change in response to a change in the wind, the generation from wind, for example. And so that allows you to modify the way you think about this system and allows you then to redesign the system to be more flexible in response to having more of these variable loads. So in the past, when the engineers would say, oh, you can't have more than 1% of wind on the system, otherwise you'll destabilize it, they were making certain assumptions about how the system had to operate. As soon as you relax those assumptions and say, well, what if we have forecasting of wind and other renewable energy flows that will allow us to anticipate these changes? What if we have more smaller power plants that are able to adjust their load more rapidly than some of these big fossil steam plants? As soon as you start making those changes and thinking about the whole system, a new reality becomes possible.
Well, your book is a wonderful guide toward that process, Cold Cash, Cool Climate. Jonathan Coomey, thanks so much for talking
with
us.
My pleasure. Glad to be here.
Jonathan Coomey. You can find out much more about Cold Cash, Cool Climate in a series about the book Coomey is doing for the blog CSR Wire Talkback. It's an online publication I write for and edit. Find a link to the series at writersvoice.net. Next up, we visit the world of wind power with Philip Warburg. Stay tuned after the break.
How many times must the cannonballs fly before they're forever banned? The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Wind energy could supply 50% of our electricity within a generation. But it already supplies 20% of Denmark's electricity and 17% of Germany's. And China is eating our lunch, surpassing the U.S. in investments in wind power to become the global leader. Wind power in the U.S. has been beset by controversy and erratic public policy. Republicans in Congress are planning cuts to wind energy credits right now. These barriers have slowed the growth of our domestic wind industry, but not choked it off entirely. Wind is still a happening thing. A study just out shows new wind generation could soon be cheaper than new coal plants. And wind is already bringing good jobs, clean energy, and much-needed income to cash-strapped farmers. In his book, Harvest the Wind, my guest Philip Warburg takes the reader on a tour of the wind industry, mainly in the U.S., but he also travels abroad to Denmark and China. In story after story, Warburg shows the people and the places that are building America's new wind energy future. Warburg is past president of the Conservation Law Foundation, New England's oldest and largest environmental watchdog group. You are the past president of the Conservation Law Foundation. Briefly tell us a little bit about your work at the foundation, and how did that lead you, or did that lead you, into doing this book?
Well, at the Conservation Law Foundation, one of our major advocacy efforts was to help move the Cape Wind offshore wind farm forward. As many of your listeners may know, the Cape Wind offshore wind farm is the first attempt to build a wind farm offshore in America. There are wind farms offshore Denmark, Germany, China, France, but we've lagged behind in this respect. And what really distressed me was finding that in New England, which prides itself on being on the environmental cutting edge, there was very considerable resistance and has been over a decade to the Cape Wind project, not by a majority of Massachusetts residents, but by a very well-funded group of Martha's Vineyard and Nantucket and Cape Cod vacationers. What was most distressing to me was that Ted Kennedy, whom we have thought of for decades as one of the leaders in the push toward a more responsible, more sustainable energy policy, was really right there at the barricades and behind the scenes opposing the Cape Wind project because he objected to the visual impacts it would have over 5 miles offshore from the Kennedy vacation compound in Hyannisport. And wind power offers so much by way of a more sustainable approach to energy. It does have a visual presence on the landscape and on the seascape, but we often don't think about the coal mines that ravage the landscapes of Appalachia, the open pit mines that have destroyed parts of Wyoming, and we also need to think about the enormous risks of other forms of energy, such as nuclear, where vast areas have been put off bounds to human habitation for decades following the accident at Chernobyl, and that will presumably be the case in the region of Fukushima as well.
And so your passion for wind led you to take this trip across the U.S., and also you visited Denmark and China, is that correct?
Yes, that's right.
And you really paint a remarkable picture of a success story about wind. I think one that would probably surprise a lot of our listeners. A success story that is not just a foreign one, but really a homegrown one here. You start the book out in Cloud County, Kansas, and you point out that the very name Kansas is connected to wind.
That's right. It's an Indian tribal term, meaning the people of the south winds. What you have in Kansas are very sustained winds blowing up off the Gulf of Mexico, across Texas, and on up into the central United States. And those winds, for a very long time, have been very much part of the culture and the history of the area, some to positive effect, some to negative effect. There are some very devastating tornadoes that we hear about that happen in that region. But the wind has been tapped since the late 1800s, actually, for water pumping. Water pumping windmills really helped open up much of the central and western United States to settlement and cultivation and cattle ranching. And what we're finding today is, in a sense, a revival of wind power in a new form that is bringing electricity on a very substantial scale, not just to the residents of places like Cloud County, but far beyond. Cloud County today has about 12,000 people living in it, and the Meridian Way Wind Farm, which began operations there in 2008, provides enough electricity for about 55,000 Kansas and Missouri households.
And you tell a fascinating story about how this got organized. I mean, first, when the attempt to build a big wind farm in Kansas first started, it ran into some serious environmental opposition. And then this guy, Jim Roberts, who sounds like a terrific community organizer, came into Cloud County and he started to develop this. Tell us about this process.
Well, he first went to an area called the Flint Hills. The Flint Hills are an area of tall grass prairie where a fairly small but very vocal group of cattle ranchers are vehemently opposed to wind power, again, for visual reasons. The prairie landscape is a very horizontal landscape, and these individuals really don't like the notion of very tall promontories. These turbines do stand at over 400 feet, interrupting that visual horizon. In Cloud County, people take a much more pragmatic view. It's a working landscape. There is grain farming, soy farming, cattle ranching, and many of the landowners in that area see wind power as another, in a sense, farm implement, an element of the farm economy. It brings a stable source of income. It provides a source of pride to the region. But what Jim Roberts did was he identified at first a small group of landowners who were interested in the possibility of developing wind power on their properties and began to assemble a large enough parcel of land, about 22,000 acres, to explore the prospects of developing a substantial wind farm. And once he had enough people on board, he moved forward with getting the necessary permits from various agencies so that he could move that wind farm forward. And in contrast to Cape Wind, which first went public in August, I think it was, of 2001, and still has not been built, the Meridian Way Wind Farm began its explorations in 2003. By 2008, the wind farm was up and running.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Philip Warburg about America's wind industry, one that is already bringing clean energy and good jobs to thousands of Americans. His book is Harvest the Wind. What kind of income are we talking about? What kind of return on investment or return to the farmers are we talking about that Jim and his company could provide them?
Well, farmers enjoy lease payments from wind farm owners. So if you have a turbine on your property, you might be getting somewhere between $5,000 and $8,000 in guaranteed annual payments, lease payments for that turbine. So some farmers have 2, 3, 4, up to 7, 8, 9 turbines on their property. So that can be a very substantial supplement to the vagaries of cattle prices, grain prices, and the like, and also there are uncertainties regarding weather in the Midwest as elsewhere, these payments are guaranteed. Beyond the lease payments, those who are hosting turbines or transformer stations or access roads or other elements of the wind farm enjoy a royalty payment depending upon how productive the wind farm is. So they're guaranteed a source of income over the full lifespan of the wind farms. And we really don't know how long these wind farms will hold up, but they're estimating that they'll hold up for at least 20, 25 years. My own personal guess is that with proper maintenance and repair, they can be providing sustainable wind power for many decades to come.
There were a lot of different pieces put together, all the way from the local level, as you've just pointed out, all the way up to the international level. Could you talk about how are the pieces put together in this industry? I mean, it's a global industry and a local industry at the same time.
One of the interesting things about wind power is that these pieces of technology are very, very large. So you have blades that are half the length of a football field, and you have towers that are in segments, but the total towers come to about 260, 280 feet. An advantage to wind power over solar is because those pieces of equipment are so large, it's actually quite expensive to move them over large expanses. So a lot of the equipment for our wind farms today is manufactured right here in America. It doesn't mean that all the companies that manufacture them are American companies, but we're seeing American jobs in very substantial numbers associated with the manufacture, the transportation, the construction, and the operation and maintenance of wind farms. So that's a real boon to the American economy as well as to our environment. In America, General Electric produces about a third of the turbines that are going up today. Second in line is a Danish company called Vestas, which has been the world leader in wind technology since the 1980s. And there are other companies that are very involved as well. There's an Indian company called Suzlon. The Chinese are very active in developing wind technology. In fact, four of the top global turbine manufacturers today are Chinese companies, and they're just beginning to explore the American marketplace. Until now, the Chinese have focused pretty substantially on developing their own domestic market for wind. They're the leader of the world in installed wind power, and they are developing wind power just like they're developing coal, just like they're developing large-scale hydroelectricity, just like they're developing nuclear power. They're basically going forward on multiple fronts because they're developing at such a rapid rate. The United States runs a close second to China in total installed wind power, but in fact, we generate more electricity from our wind farms than the Chinese do because the Chinese state-owned enterprises don't have the same incentive to maximize productivity. But we're seeing lots and lots of American jobs that are coming out of this industry, and more of the content of these wind turbines is being produced in America. So today, if you look at an average turbine that is being erected, about 60% of the value of that turbine is American-made.
And that's even if it's a company like Vestas that...
Exactly.
Now, you do go to Denmark and you visit the Vestas factory there. Denmark is a big success story for wind, not only because the country gets some 20% of its power from wind, and it wants to go to 80% by 2050, but it also, as you say, is the leading producer of it. Not only the leading producer, but has been producing wind turbines for a long time. Is it since the oil shock of the 1970s is when it kind of got started? Is that right?
That's exactly right. Denmark, when the 1973 oil embargo hit, really rose to the challenge. At that point, Denmark was 90% dependent upon oil for all of its energy needs, and it recognized that that was a very precarious place to be. So it began to develop policies that would promote alternatives to oil, wind power being a very significant one of them. I should note that Denmark did not go in the direction of developing nuclear power. unlike France, Germany, and other European countries. But it really made a big bet on wind technology and other technologies. It developed coal as well. But as you mentioned, Denmark today is 20% reliant upon wind, and it has a remarkable capacity to think into the future. And frankly, this could be, an inspiration to us. I think Americans and American politicians, unfortunately, think too much in terms of the next election campaign and not enough in terms of what we really need to do to build a sustainable environment here in America and globally. In Denmark, a Commission on Climate Change Policy was established recently, and it came out with the recommendation that you alluded to, that the country should be about 80% reliant upon wind power by 2050. Now, that's part of a much bigger plan, which is to get off of fossil fuels entirely by 2050. To do so, it will have to develop renewable resources to provide its electricity. It will have to shift a lot of its automobile fleet over to either biofuels or wind power generated electric vehicles. And it's made a commitment to move in that direction. I wish in America we could have the same kind of vision so that we would begin to think about how we can lead the world as opposed to lag the world in addressing the overarching challenge of global warming and climate change.
If you just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Philip Warburg about his book, Harvest the Wind, America's Journey to Jobs, Energy Independence, and Climate Stability. So if Denmark is already getting 20% of its power from wind, you know, there are a lot of critics who say that, you know, the maximum amount, because of the way that the electric grid is constructed, that the maximum amount we could ever get wind supply to our economy is somewhere in the order of 5 or 6%. Is it just because Denmark is so small that it's able to have such a great percentage, or is it just that what the naysayers are saying isn't true?
Well, first, there are parts of America today that get much more than 5 or 6% of their electricity from wind. For example, South Dakota gets about 22% of its electricity from wind. Iowa gets about 19% of its electricity from wind. Even Texas, which we think of as the big oil state, Texas, I should mention, is the largest electricity consumer in the country, gets about 7% of its electricity from wind. We could be providing half of our electricity from wind if we made a very serious investment in building out a smart grid that could transport wind from the areas where it's most abundant to the areas where the power is most needed. So, for example, if you look at a state like Wyoming, small state, about 700,000 people, doesn't need more electricity produced in state, but has wonderful wind resources and is now in the process of planning out some very large wind farms that would be connected to the Southern Nevada and Southern California electricity markets, providing clean energy to those regions that really need that clean energy. And it would help California, for example, meet its very ambitious standard. There's something called a renewable portfolio standard that many states have adopted, about 30 states, which requires utilities to purchase a minimum amount of their electricity from qualifying renewable technologies, including wind. California has set its goal as 33% of its overall electricity coming from those qualifying renewable resources by the year 2020. So they're looking hard to find the resources out of state as well as in state that could help them meet that very ambitious and very laudable goal. I should also just mention that John Wellinghoff, who is the chair of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, not a dreamer, a solid, responsible politician and agency head, predicts that we could be getting half of our electricity from wind by 2050 if we were to make the right infrastructure investments.
Well, some people say that building that smart grid has its own environmental problems. How difficult would it be to do that in a way that both preserves the environment and doesn't break the budget?
Well, I should just mention that any large energy technology comes with some infrastructural burdens. Right now, the latest magic cure is fracked natural gas. extracting natural gas from deep deposits through a process that injects toxic chemicals into the earth to break up the substrates and release gas. It's a very disruptive process. There's a lot of question as to what it does to groundwater, what it might do to surface waters when the extraction fluids are pumped out. And natural gas right now requires about 2.4 million miles of pipeline built across this country to deliver it from where it's produced to where it's used. And they're planning on vastly expanding that infrastructure. So you can't simply look at wind power in a vacuum. You have to really look at what are the alternatives. Transmission lines are costly, but if you're generating free electricity from wind, which is what you can do once you've built these large wind farms, then the transmission cost can be well within bounds. The Department of Energy did a study in 2008 called Wind Power in America's Future, 20% by 2030, made an estimate of what it would cost to build the grid to accommodate that substantial infusion of wind. And the estimate was that it would cost about $60 billion beyond what would be spent anyway in upgrading our transmission infrastructure. That would translate into about $30 per household per year from 2012 to 2030, which would be about $2.50 per household per month during that period. If you contrast that with the cost of continuing down the road to global warming with all of its disastrous consequences, I think that would be a pretty good deal.
Sounds like it would be a great bargain. I mean, the cost of that is incalculable in terms of human life and species loss, but it, in terms of lost GDP, it translates into trillions.
That's exactly right. And just by the way, Denmark, which we discussed as having a zero fossil fuel future, estimates that as part of the plan to wean itself entirely off of fossil fuels, it would be doubling its gross domestic product and would be thriving as an economy. So we're not talking about pain and suffering here. We're talking about a transition to a fuel source that is super abundant and clean, as opposed to a fuel source that will cause us great economic harm, human suffering, and devastation to the environment.
And also it would result in a decrease in energy costs. Wind, once you build the infrastructure, the wind, it's free.
That's absolutely right. Wind farms have an upfront capital cost, but right now, wind is fairly close to competitive with even natural gas. There's a very hot debate going on right now in Congress over renewal of something called the production tax credit, which is a 2.2 cent per kilowatt hour tax credit that wind producers can enjoy. That tax credit is a very important equalizer so that wind power can compete with technologies that have been very heavily subsidized over decades and decades. And I'm including the gas industry, the oil industry, the coal industry, the nuclear industry. And unfortunately, there are strong industrial interests that are pushing for the non-renewal of that tax credit. But we've been subsidizing different energy technologies for a very long time, and building out a transmission grid that could allow us to move toward a sustainable energy future would be a very sound investment, and one that we would see multiple benefits from, environmental and economic.
One of the economic benefits, which you've alluded to before, is jobs. Tell us the job story that you discovered. I believe you went to Iowa, and that's the chapter in your book, Philip Warburg, Harvest the Wind. That's a chapter that focuses on jobs.
The jobs are abundant and will be much more abundant if we really pursue an ambitious goal of, let's say, 20% of our electricity coming from wind by 2030, or Chairman Wellinghoff's even more ambitious goal of 50% of our electricity coming from wind by 2050. Even today, when wind power nationwide is generating about 3.5% of our total electricity, there are about 80,000 jobs in the wind industry. One of the concerns is that if the production tax credit is allowed to expire, those jobs could drop by about 38,000. So that would be a pretty devastating impact on many people who have turned to wind as a very promising new career and a new technology. Iowa hosts, I think, 8 different turbine manufacturing facilities, as well as many of the suppliers of components and subcomponents for wind technology. And it's really helped turn around some flagging heavy industry bases. For example, in Cedar Rapids, there's a company called Clipper Wind, which has built a turbine assembly plant there. It used to be a plant that manufactured printing presses for the newspaper industry, and the company came in there, retrained some of the workers from the printing press industry, and also brought in a whole new cohort of well-trained technicians to work in this assembly plant. And so you now have a few hundred jobs in that factory producing wind power technology, which is quite wonderful. And not so far from Cedar Rapids is a town called Newton, Iowa, which used to be the headquarters for the Maytag Corporation. Maytag pulled out of that town and left many people jobless. There are now 2 wind factories in that town. One manufactures towers and the other manufactures blades that have reinfused jobs into the local economy and helped really keep that town going. Many people are now looking to the wind industry as a promising new career, and there are job training programs that are arising in places like Iowa. There's a community college called Iowa Lakes Community College, where a wind technology training program has been developed. In Cloud County, Kansas, the Cloud County Community College has developed its training program, and that's actually quite a wonderful story, because in 2007, a former high school science teacher named Bruce Graham approached the administrators at Cloud County Community College and said, you know, wind technology is really up and coming, and I think it would be great if the college developed its own program, because we have a need, and it would be a great way for us to raise the profile of this college as well as bring meaningful jobs to Cloud County. And at the time, the administrators were a bit skeptical. Bruce had, I think, about 4 students who were interested in the program. But the administrators said, well, we'll lease you some space. So they found some classroom space sandwiched between a general store and a Chinese restaurant in a shopping mall and let him go about his business. Well, today, that program has over 100 students enrolled, and Bruce Graham's biggest challenge is keeping people in that program for the full 2 years so that they can get their certificate before they get snapped up by the wind industry. It's an industry that's looking for well-qualified technicians, and it's a great opportunity for people who might have been laid off by the construction industry, people coming out of the military service, people looking for new challenges and looking for a new career that can really help move their families into the future as well as our country into the future.
Philip Warburg. His book is Harvest the Wind, America's Journey to Jobs, Energy Independence, and Climate Stability. Go to writersvoice.net to hear the rest of our interview with Warburg. We just couldn't fit it into today's show, and you shouldn't miss it. He talks about the politics of wind, environmental controversies, and public policy. You can also see a photo of an innovative wind turbine, one that flies. That's at writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox, or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.